All right, you can see our website up there. And Dave asked me a couple of months ago, some time back in last year, would I come up and run a Worldview Conference for you? And then the Presbyterian Church in South Street, Christ Life, decided to put on a month of meetings. So Dave and I agreed to do Sunday morning. And so then they decided to put it here in the campus. So this morning's an interesting mix and match of a Worldview Conference, evidence, and because it's a Sunday morning service for a church, it's going to be interesting to see how it actually turns out. I liked encouraging people, by the way, and as you came in, you would have seen a free table. Free is easy, free you don't have to buy. Make use of it afterwards. But there's also a table where there's some unfree things, right? So if you're interested in unfree stuff, then have a look at that table as well. And my wife is out there, and Dr. Diane Eager, they will be at the table, and I'll be out there afterwards as well if you want to chat to me. But to make it a bit easier for you, and to kick off this morning, as I often do, I like to give away things in return for an answer to a question. Okay, in fact, I'll ask two questions because I've got two things to give away. One is a new book on Genesis by a geologist, Terry Mortensen, and a theologian, Thane Urey, both with PhDs in the relevant subject. And the other is a new DVD, the one you've got the promo on, Darwin's Evolution. So if you want to see that there are a lot of scientists who do believe the world was intelligently designed and the universe, and they believe the biblical account as well, we filmed that last year all around the globe. But to win either of those prizes at the moment, the first person gets the chance to take a choice. Can anybody tell me what month last year Charles Darwin, if he was alive, would have been 200 years old? Don't you teach them anything in this church, Darwin? Well, look, now we have a second question. We have a very famous atheist who's been visiting Queensland in the last week. Anyone know his name? Yes, up the back of your hand up first. Richard Dawkins. Dan, you come and get your prize. Oh, you're waiting for somebody out there. That's okay. Well, you can get your prize later on. So that's good. Okay, just in case there's somebody here, this ad might be interesting too. In creation research, we have a secretary, but she's having more and more trouble reaching the computer. So we need a replacement secretary because this one's pregnant and her and her husband are expecting a baby in May and will be retiring quite shortly to start a family. So if any young lady with computer skills in Windows and, you know, Office and all that sort of stuff, Vista, etc., is interested in a ministry job in creation research, see me afterwards. I would love to get together. Okay, just a little bit of background then. What we're going to try and do in this session is give you an overall worldview, apply it with one particular way that might be helpful to you, whether you are dealing with fossils or fiction or fantasy or Dawkins or Darwin or any subject, including facts about Christianity. I was asked last year to give a lecture in Shrewsbury Abbey. The reason being, of course, Charles Darwin's hometown was Shrewsbury. He was born there. Darwin, of course, is famous for the theory of evolution, and Dawkins is his most well-known atheist advocate at the moment. Of course, the interesting thing was, it was a year ago, February. By the way, their churches make ours look like our houses in most cases. These are grand and glorious buildings, built over 1,000, you know, around about 1,000 years ago. We had a pretty good crowd, but I froze to death. It was the coldest winter in 27 years. And of course, as I looked around the building, I scratched my head because I puzzled about one thing. There wasn't a single fireplace in the whole building. Of course, I later on learned that that was because when the Normans built these buildings, it was a lot warmer in England in those days. That's one reason, by the way, why we put all that sort of information on DVDs, which are available out there. Climate change is probably the second most popular topic we get asked to talk on in this year and last year as well. But I was in Shrewsbury Abbey to announce the release of that DVD, Darwin on the Rocks. By the way, don't you love the English language? English is such a flexible language, you can almost say anything you want and it needs a lawyer to prove you meant it. Darwin on the rocks, well, it's got two meanings, hasn't it? One, this is about rocks and fossils. But the other means it's a shipwreck. It's crashed on the same rocks and fossils. So if you want to go all around the globe following us and looking at the evidence worldwide, well, that's what we released that for. But in England in 2009, the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin, patron saint almost of academia over there, you can't go criticising him without the press catching up with you. The Guardian is sort of not exactly a right-wing newspaper. Left to centre would be the closest it normally gets. But they did a nice big weekend lift out on creationism in the UK. Funny thing was, I was the person who got my picture in the paper. But I didn't mind that. But what was intriguing them was this. You see, a few weeks before, they'd done a survey of Britain. And they said, as of February the 1st, in their survey, a half of Britons reject evolution. So they wanted to know from me, what are you blokes doing that is so effective? You don't have millions of pounds like David Attenborough does. The Daily Telegraph, in their website, expanded even further. It says, in England, as of February 2009, one in three now believe God created the world within the past 10,000 years. Now, I was pleased to hear that. I don't know if it's true or not, but they say it is. Interesting thing, it didn't please everybody, including my arch-enemy, Richard Dawkins, because he said, what this data proves is, well, much of the British population is pig-ignorant about science. Now, I had Dawkins turn up to one of my meetings with a camera crew and all that sort of stuff, and when he talks with me, I love to remind him that if he thinks the public is pig-ignorant about science because they don't no longer accept creation, then guess whose fault it must be, because he's been the professor for public understanding of science since 1995. By the way, they played that program last year on October the 11th in the UK. You can see quite a bit of it on YouTube, except when Dawkins gets it pulled off. So some weeks it's on, some weeks it's not. But I did take the opportunity of reminding Dawkins that he had an interview with Bill Moyers in the USA back in 2004, and Moyers asked him, is evolution a theory, not a fact? And Dawkins replied, evolution has been observed, it's just that it hasn't been observed while it's been happening. By the way, I checked with him when he turned up at my meeting, and he still believes that. I regard that man as very bright, but not very wise. I don't know about you, but he just made a stupid statement. Dawkins could, of course, have picked up National Geographic in November 2004 that asked that question, was Darwin wrong? Or alternatively, he could and did pick up New Scientist of January last year that answered the question. Darwin was wrong. Now, don't hear me wrong. It's not that the guys writing this were creationists. But they said this, if Charles Darwin, whose theory is molecules to man, if you actually take it out there and apply it to where the rubber meets the road, it doesn't work. Because they're hoping they can get a better theory of evolution. None of them showed any interest in sort of saying, well, perhaps we should abandon it and move to creation. Of course, Dawkins wasn't too happy about that, but Dawkins could have also picked up Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. You shouldn't even need to open your Bibles for this Bible reading, should you? Because Genesis chapter 1, well, I'll give you the modern translation. Darwin was really, really wrong. By the way, you do know what it literally says, don't you? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, now I will get you to open your Bibles because as we look at this issue, origin of life, is the Bible true from the beginning, then you have to first of all know what it says. I get many people who say to me, I don't believe what the Bible says. So I ask them what it says and they don't usually know. Genesis chapter 1 verse 1 we've already quoted. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Alright, let me give you a twist to that as we go. There's the first good news that distinguishes it from evolution. You didn't happen by accident. God did it. Go down to verse 26. And God said, let us make man in our image and after our likeness, and let them have dominion authority, control. Do you realise Genesis chapter 1 is the beginning of what Christians should all label good news? Number one, you didn't happen by accident. Number two, you're not animals. I was down in Melbourne at Christmas time with my kids, and we went to a kids show at the Melbourne Museum. And they hammered and hammered and hammered, we're animals, we're animals, we're animals. And then they complain about bullying, survival of the fittest, kids shooting each other. What's the illogicity there? Now go to verse 31 of Genesis chapter 1. And God saw all that he made, and it was very... Okay, Genesis chapter 1, good news. You didn't get here by accident. You're not animals, and everything God did was very good. Okay, now, today we are only going to really cover one sort of sea. If you want to deal with a lot more evidence, go to our website, click on the search button, click on the three search engines there, click on evidence search, and just ask it anything you like, right? And we try to make it fairly user-friendly. All right, now, Charles Darwin graduated with a Master of Arts in Theology. If you studied theology in England before somebody called Charles Darwin invented the theory of evolution, guess what black-covered, leather-bound book you usually read at university? The Bible. No doubt about it. He knew his Bible because he quoted from it in his own biography. But he's more famous for that. The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. He's even got his statue outside his old school. Ah, long time old school, that one. Wow, hundreds and hundreds of years of history. But you see, what Darwin really has done is give everybody a picture of how to see things. There's Dawkins' picture. Molecules, somehow all by themselves, because there is no God, totally naturalistically, it wasn't deliberately designed, it's random, it's accidental, you are just the end result of the properties of hydrogen doing its thing for billions of years. Or David Attenborough, chimpanzee-like creatures on the left, Mr. Rudd on the right. That's the picture that he portrays. Or you go to the zoos. We share 99% of our genes, 98% of our genes with chimpanzees. Or Melbourne Museum. We're animals, we're animals, we're animals. If you want the big picture of evolution, there's three very important concepts. Life is a struggle, only the fittest survive, and you die because it's natural, get used to it, or solve the problem yourself. Find that life eternal pill. There's another way of putting it. Molecules on the left out of the Big Bang somehow turned into us, and don't think it's stopped. If you think it's stopped, just watch the next episode of Star Wars. Right? They take evolution seriously, and we're getting bigger brains, losing our legs because we play with computers too much, and we're going to float into a bottle of fluid and just communicate through the ether. They believe it. But of course, it's not just a picture of physical history. It's got moral implications. Now, I've got to admit, Professor William Provine is a far more consistent atheist than Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins doesn't think very fast on his feet. That's quote-unquote, by the way, because I publicly challenged him to debate me on the spot, and he said he wouldn't because he doesn't think fast, and I agree he doesn't. But William Provine is unbelievably logical. Look what he said in his Darwin's Day address in Tennessee. Naturalistic evolution has clear consequences that Charles Darwin understood perfectly. No gods worth having exist, no life after death exists, no ultimate foundation for ethics exists, no ultimate meaning in life exists, human free will is non-existent. By the way, do you think a Christian could agree with a theory that has those philosophical implications? Because a Christian says in the beginning it didn't happen by accident, God made us. We're not just animals, we were made by God in the image of God who has a will, so we must have some sort of a will. And everything God did was very good. Choose this day who you will serve, because that is God's challenge to people. Richard Dawkins, he sees the application. The central belief of Christianity is that the creator of the universe, the inventor of galaxies, couldn't think of a better way of ridding the world of sin than to get himself tortured on a cross. How pathetic. I listen to him say that myself. That's 100% accurate. He sees that if atheistic evolutionism is true, then people like Dave Kiwi, they have to be locked up. There's something wrong with them. They have to be legislated against. Darwin, remember, his world, graduated, Master of Arts in Theology, he knew what it was he was trying to get rid of. Problem is, many Christians who are defending the Bible don't actually know what they're defending. So let me give you a few clues. We've already mentioned this. God made the world very good, and if we'd have gone through every verse in Genesis 1, you would have read 10 times that God created creatures after their own kind. Then you read a definition of what good means. You see, we see the word good as moral. No mention of morals in Genesis chapter 1. Good covers everything, the weather. It covers diet. All the creatures, there was no death. They were all vegetarian. No struggle, no killing, no carnivores, no parasites. Man alive, that was a good world. And since you're in Toowoomba, you need to know that in Genesis, a mist rose up every morning and watered the whole surface of the earth. Now in Toowoomba, that would be good. Genesis goes on to chapter 3, which tells you the bad news. And by the way, the bad news is really bad, because the good news was really good. The good news was, God made everything very good, don't you dare blame him for anything bad. The bad news is, we chose to rebel against the Creator. God curses the ground, death enters the planet. By the time of Noah, you notice our timeline, by the way? It's the opposite of the normal concept that many people have about evolution. We're starting at almost perfection and we're heading downhill. The Bible's big picture, life is not an accident, man is not an animal, and everything God made was very good. And the bad news, you don't die because you get old. Death is not a biological necessity, death is a moral penalty. And the application, the only way out is if the penalty is paid. Vast difference in the way these two systems see things. Note one, by the way, by the time you get from Adam to Noah, people have been alive for nearly 1,000 years. After Noah, his son Shem drops dead at 600. Arphaxad drops dead at 400. Job is dead around about 300. You know, by the time you get to Abraham, he's dead at nearly 200. You and I are barely going to make it to 100. Change is true. But you see, that's evolution. We start out from hydrogen, it wasn't alive, and we end up as people who are trying to pay the scientists to make us live longer. Totally different, but both involve change. Now, I thought I'd give us an application of contemporary evolution. Dr. Diane Eager, who for many years was a medical biologist at Canberra University, is part of our team. She's up the back, so I've actually taken a talk she prepared, giving you a short version of it. You can ask her for all the missing details later on. But the BBC News on December the 8th announced that those wretched colonials were evolving still. There was an example of contemporary evolution amongst our snakes. The data? Snakes eat frogs and toads. Of course, the cane toad is a foreign import. Remember that biological experiment where we had cane beetles, so we bought in Buffo americanus, and Buffo americanus decided to eat anything except the cane beetles. Green snakes and red-bellied blacks are particularly susceptible to cane toad toxin. Now, you know the pads on the shoulder of the cane toad, if you're sort of annoyed, it will froth up. Well, that toxin is what kills dogs, and it also kills some snakes. If you've never seen a green tree snake, there's plenty of them around Brisbane at the moment, and I've got a few red-bellied blacks down my way. Those snakes are particularly susceptible to the toxin. Okay, here's what the scientists did. They measured how big their heads were before and after cane toad introduction into the situation. They found the relative head size on highly susceptible and less susceptible snakes. Okay, so they went around measuring how wide their jaws were, how top the distance from the bottom to the top of the skull, etc. There's the comment made as a summary, but for two species of snakes at least, natural selection has produced a defence. The snakes have developed relatively smaller heads and longer bodies. Okay, now do you know what I discovered? I went down the back last February 2008 when we had lots of rain and therefore lots of toads, and here was a nice green snake sneaking up on a toad, and it grabbed it. And I said, don't do that. It'll be the last meal you have. Snake ignored me, grabbed the toad and slithered away as fast as it could. Ah, okay. Two species of snake, natural selection has produced a defence. Let's keep going. Snakes in Australia have evolved, said the BBC, to counter the threat of invasive poisonous cane toads, and it's an example of contemporary evolution. Now, the fact is, what they've done, they've started out with a pool of snakes. The snakes that die are the ones who've got mouths that are big enough to actually eat the toads. The ones with mouths that are too small can't eat the toads, so they survive. Okay, you're following the database now? All right, they call this evolution. Full details. Adapting to invasive species, toxic cane toads induce morphological change in Australian snakes. I put that up just in case you want to read the whole blinking lot for yourself. Right? It's all there. You can get all the data that you wish. But now before I give you an alternative commentary on it, I want to introduce you to something. If Charles Darwin's done anything for people, and that includes everybody from the Archbishop of Canterbury down, who's an evolutionist, to Kevin Rudd and Mr. Abbott, who are evolutionists, to many of the people associated with evangelical Christianity, they wear Darwin's glasses and they don't even know it. What do we mean? Number one, you call all change evolution. Doesn't matter what sort it is. Number two, you accept any change as proof of evolution, and therefore you turn around and dismiss creation as unthinkable. Let me sort of illustrate what I mean. There's a snake. He's a sort of a very active green snake. But the facts are, if big-headed snakes eat the big cane toad, it's too late to change, agree? It doesn't get time to mutate. It is dead. If you want to prove this, just go and eat a couple of dozen cane toads yourself. You don't get time to adapt. Small-headed snakes don't need to change because they never could fit their mouth around the toad in the first place. So if toads become popular as they migrate through Australia and the snakes decide to eat them, then in one fell swoop, what's going to happen to the big mouth ones? The gene for big mouth is removed from the population. Fat heads die and thin heads stay alive. There's a moral somewhere there, and I'm not quite sure what it is. But the reality is, when you say something like that, natural selection ensures these small-headed snakes are the snakes that prosper and reproduce. Their body head traits come to dominate the population. I've got no problem with that at all. That's exactly what's happening. But there used to be genes for fat heads and genes for thin heads, and the fat heads are being eliminated. They're dying. Change? Yes. Evolution? I'm sorry, the skinny heads were already there. When you have a look, if you want to see more evidence on this, then I'd encourage you, go and have a look at the website, look up snake, there's all sorts of information there. But you see what the BBC and the researchers have done? There's population change. Big heads and little heads used to exist. Now we've only got mostly little heads. That's a change. If change is true, evolution is true. And then most people say if evolution is true, the Bible is false. And then they assume if we've proved that we've now got mostly small snake mouths, then snakes were never created. That is the logic most people follow. Okay, let me introduce commercial because I'm in charge here and you just have to put up with what I'm doing. We're running a field trip to the outback and to the south coast. In July, we're taking people in a hands-on dig-it-up fossil dig, starting up here in Queensland, because our coastline has not only got beautiful blue-eyed blondes that are out there, that's my wife, by the way, but it's also got a fossil, and I point it out so you don't get too confused. Sorry, darling, but it was... you can hit me later. We're going from the north to south coast of Queensland, all the way down to Newcastle, where you too, like Dr. Andy McIntosh from Leeds University, you joined me a few weeks ago, can get to see these fabulous polystrate trees, which exist by the hundreds, and begin to ponder, well, if that's a fossil pine tree there, then how long did it take to produce that much sedum? Because pine trees are softwood, and softwood rots, so, sorry, that can't have taken very long at all. Or if you want the more luxury one, we're going to take you right the way out through central Queensland and southern Queensland and South Australia. And that was Lake Eyre when I was out there last year. I suspect it'll be like that again this year, because 2 years with great rains, then we should see Lake Eyre full. And it was pretty enough last year. There were a gazillion birds out there. I'm sure it'll be great. By the way, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see Lake Eyre full. It's very rarely full. We're going to go to fabulous fossil places. We're going to go to see Lightning Ridge, not just the pretty opals, but the opalized monsters that are there as well. And if you want more information there, there's a brochure outside. I'd encourage you to pick it up and read at your leisure or see it on our website. Okay, last half before we sort of try and give you a punchline, then hopefully we'll have a few SMS questions, or it'll be 12 o'clock and Dave will tell us we have to go and have lunch or whatever. I debated Dr. Michael Caldwell in the university there in Alberta. He's got a bit of a reputation as a fossil finder, particularly for fossil snakes. There's his statement. The fossil record serves as a historical test of change over time. He was debating in favour of Darwin's evolution. I was there defending creation and espousing it, etc. I put a but at the bottom there. But does the fossil record show change, which is that? Because that's the sort of change you have to see. Oh, if evolution is true, it does include the story of beetles flying from this country and losing their wings when they land on an island. But you see, that doesn't help you find out where beetles came from that used to have wings. You have to do the bit from hydrogen to beetles before you've got that theory going. So is the type of change you see there, or is it that sort of change? You start out with beetles and they go downhill. What sort of change do you actually see? Because we're on snakes today, forgive me for using a couple of illustrations I found very helpful and useful in the climate change ones. A giant snake that was, you know, 42.5 feet long, fossil snake. It weighed up to 2,500 pounds, 1,300 kilos or something. 45 feet, 15 metres, one group calculated. Titanoboa. Here it is, pictured beside a London bus. Now that's a snake. Now we've got a few fossil snakes in Australia, but you see, none are as big as this, and Dr. Head suggested that the reason it got so big was because it lived in a world that had much more carbon dioxide. Wow, did you know that if there's more carbon dioxide, the plants do better? If the plants do better, the animals can do better? That's his logic. You don't believe him, by the way. Build a greenhouse and pump CO2 into it. Your plants will do an awful lot better. We've got some fossil snakes in Australia. They're not as big as the ones that have been found overseas, but having seen many of them, they're bigger than the ones we've still got today. Okay, beyond a shadow of a doubt, if you're looking at the fossil evidence for boas and constrictors, then you've got evidence that big pythons, the only ones left now, are little pythons. And big pythons to little pythons is definitely a change. But is it that? Or is it that? You see, the biblical picture is a history of change. I sometimes get annoyed when I hear churches singing all things bright and beautiful when the world's a horrible mess. Do you realise the world is not all things bright and beautiful? The Bible tells you it started that way, and there are many pretty things. I mean, I went to Washington State and it had been snowing. And they pointed out how pretty the snow was. Now, I'm an Aussie. Closest I've got to cold is the deep freeze. I put my finger in that stuff and I said, pretty awful, actually. It's cold. It's freezing. It can kill you, by the way, and that's not very good. The interesting thing about your Bible is it's a history of change, but it's not evolution. It's a very depressing picture, almost. I can understand why people don't like it, because if we're going on the up and up and we can improve and control the future, surely that's good news. Well, the Bible starts out with good news that it didn't begin this way. Then the bad news is we blew it, and look at what we have done. In fact, it goes on with lots of details. Diane Eager produced that graph for me because I thought we need a visual way to communicate to people the sort of information that's in the Bible. Why do we do that? Well, the fact is, most people read their Bible as a religious book. And to be honest, the Bible's got religion in it. But it's also got sex, it's got murder, it's got rape, it's got pillage, it's got you name it, including, look at the top, the history of the weather.
And look at the correlation with lifespans.
No doubt about it, if you come with me to Alaska, I'll introduce you to the chubby little Inuit who live out in the snow all year, and they're dead by the time they're 45. Why they're against global warming beats me. And who wants to live in the cold and be dead too soon? Well, the interesting thing, when you have a look at the Bible, I've been, over the years, trying to summarise where I'm getting to, and that's a good position at this point in the lecture. There are many theories that disagree with everything in the Bible, but the facts don't. The facts are in total agreement with the faith. So let me challenge you at this point to begin to think that through. You see, I'd left university with millions of years of evolution in my head. It wasn't until I began to ask questions like, hang on, yes, the theory of evolution disagrees with Genesis. I haven't seen a thing evolve in all my work with Drosophila melanogaster, fruit flies, berries. I haven't seen a thing evolve. I'm in geology, I haven't seen the fossils proven. Question, if it is true that God made things to produce after their kind, what would I expect to see in a world that started out good and then went downhill? Let me sort of help you. I got off the airport at Heathrow, picked up the Guardian, they had that picture on the front. Hello, snakies. I, of course, read the Times preferably because it tends to be a little more accurate. April 20th, 2006, they had a photo of the actual fossil of this snake. Oh, but this was a snake that had been found with hips and little legs. In fact, the report that was in Nature, you see it's been printed in Nature back in April 2006. Nature, by the way, is the world's oldest and most prestigious scientific magazine. You get into Nature, you have made it. Now, quote unquote, the fossil of a snake with hips was found in South America, lived more than 65 million years ago. They called it Najax Rio Grina, which takes its name from the leg snake described in the Bible. Okay. Of course, that creates a problem for anybody in South Australia at the moment, where creationism has been banned even in the Christian schools. Can you imagine how I'd run a science lesson on describing this fossil? This fossil has been called Najax Rio Grina, which takes its name from the leg snake described in the Bible. Now, would I tell the students now, if you want to find out about this, open up your Bibles? Oh no, you can't do that. They'd have to move across to religious education to do that. Obviously, these scientists have a bit of knowledge of a snake, a reptile, a serpent that's mentioned somewhere in the Bible. So let's look it up. Genesis chapter 3, verse 14, there's my summary. God told the serpent, the Hebrew word is Najash, he will go on its belly all the days of its life. And all you need to do is pick up any sort of old-fashioned Sunday school course where they drew pictures of this, and if the serpent from now on would have to crawl on its belly, then everybody assumes it used to once what? Walk. That's the standard sort of view, and including that's what the scientist who named this reptile said it did. Okay? Your biblical picture seems to imply that snake, serpent-like creatures had legs. Now they don't. What type of change is that? Well, remember I told you I debated Dr. Michael Caldwell? He's famous for finding marine snake with legs. He called it Pachyrhynchus problematicus, which is Latin, but what on earth is it? Okay, it's got hind limbs. He's not the only one. There's Hassosaurus pterosanthus. And look at the legs at the bottom. Nature's provided a nice little diagram of a limb snake with the whole limbs there. And even on the BBC website, there's the discovery of another one with limbs. Now you live in a world where you are hard pushed to find any snakes with limbs at all. In fact, your biblical picture, snakes have changed, they used to have legs, now they don't. What type of a change would that be and how has it occurred? Because obviously the scientists who named this new discovery had this concept out of Genesis. So perhaps it's not as unscientific as people think it is. Okay, Dr. Caldwell again and his colleagues, who made a study of this, said none of the more than 50 groups of limb-reduced reptiles and amphibians have ever re-evolved legs, demonstrating this reacquisition is very unlikely. In other words, if you start out with wings and you lose them, we don't seem to be able to get them back. You start out with arms and you lose them, then it's very unlikely you're going to get them back. You start out with legs like these, no evidence in the whole history, and they're reading the history of the rocks as hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of years. I no longer believe that, but it's not relevant to the discussion here at the moment. You can ask me questions about that later. Let me show you what Caldwell and Co. are doing. Remember I mentioned Darwin's glasses? You call all change evolution. Then you accept any change in snakes as proof of evolution. Then you dismiss creation as unthinkable. In other words, if it's true that snakes started out with legs, then if they've lost their legs, this must be evidence of change. Change is evolution. If evolution is true, then all of a sudden snakes never were created in the beginning, no matter what they started as. Of course, you don't usually apply this rule to thalidomide kids. Some of you are old enough. Remember when Mum took thalidomide for morning pain, morning sickness? And a whole generation of kids were born without legs. Nobody said, we're evolving. Everybody said, this is a degeneracy caused by the drug company, because if they called it evolution, they wouldn't have been able to sue anybody, correct? That was a degenerate change. Dr. Michael Caldwell, the fossil record serves as a historical test of change over time. The poor guy got a real shock when I said, that's totally correct. But the sort of change you see is no help to Darwin's theory of evolution. Because even if you believe in the 95 million years ago that Pterosanctus hapiopus supposedly had legs and now its descendants don't, then they've been snakes, they've had legs, and they've lost their legs. Look at the word I put up there. Now, I'll be honest with you, Richard Dawkins doesn't like me using that word. He's told me so, right? But it's much better than his word. E means to come out of, devolve means to go downhill, to degenerate. Look, you Aussies shouldn't have trouble with leg snakes. They've got pythons. Look, thumb underneath the little limb there. When you x-ray them, look what you see. The whole rest of the limb structure is still in there. It's just almost functionless. Now, don't think you have to die because your legs fall off or get smaller. Haven't you seen people with little arms who can still do wonderful things? Yeah, you've got to lose it all before you can't use it. We even see it happening as you live here in Australia today. Surprise, surprise, of all the groups on the planet, guess which group? Fishes, amphibians, reptiles, birds. Guess which group is losing limbs at the fastest observed rate? It's still the reptiles. They really are. I mean, I took this guy out in the rain the one day, get close up, look at his little funny useless legs. Now, of course, he still has the ability to move his body, but he had that before he lost his legs. That's how lizards with legs walk. So he had a backup method that would work even if he lost his legs. It's interesting when you contemplate design, because I have a friend who works for Boeing Aerospace. He's actually recently retired. He's the guy that designed the guidance system on the space shuttle. And you know, he was saying, when we design something, we deliberately build in two levels of redundancy. So if you're flying a big Boeing 747, you have the computer which runs everything, right? And then if that fails, you have the hydraulic system. And if that fails, you're back to pulling levers. If that fails, you put a parachute on, right? And he said, we deliberately do it. And he said, what we've discovered is there's not any more room to put things after you've reached that third level. The maximum efficiency is to have the system that works and have two backups that function to a lesser degree. The lizard does that. But look what Dick Smith has done. You know, Dick Smith, the guy who's running around saying, all you kids, you should have only two kids each when you get married. In legless lizards, this is out of his Australian National Geographic, there is a bulge above the eye, and unlike snakes, they have ears. The term legless lizard is in fact a misnomer. They have hind legs, but evolution has reduced these to nothing more than scale flaps. Look what he's done. He's defined evolution as change. Then he's argued they used to have legs, now they've lost them. That's change. If change is true, change is evolution. If evolution is true, take it from me, Dick Smith. There is no God. There is no Bible that's true. That's where he's gone to. That's why he says, we must be in control, so we must be gods who determine how many kids you people can have. Interesting. Dismiss creation as unthinkable. He's done exactly this. He's defined evolution as change, then he's accepted any change in snakes or lizards as proof of it, then he's dismissed creation as unthinkable. Question. Does the data from lizards or snakes, or even people fit that? Or does it fit that? The world was made very good. We sin. It's our fault. Don't you blame God. The world's gone from good to bad. Then we've rebelled and rebelled and rebelled and asked questions like, well, if God loves us, why are the poor children in Iraq suffering when it's us who are going to war to keep the oil in Iraq? That's what it's all about. The world's gone from good to bad to worse. Don't you dare blame God. Question, is it that it fits, or is it this? When it comes to the climate change issue, you know, the Al Gore movie featuring the ever popular polar bear that's in danger, and it's your fault, right? Now, the interesting thing is, people are saying, well, look, if climate change, global warming continues, then creatures are going to die, they're going to become extinct. It's sad. Nobody says, well, look, this is a wonderful opportunity for the polar bear to evolve. You know, the kids at school are being told, look, creatures are dying out every week, and it's true. And since I was this high, hundreds of creatures have tottered on the edge of extinction. Some have gone right over. Yeah, but I graduated in geology. I deliberately went and did 3 years of genetics, and there wasn't one example that our professor could point to of a new creature that had evolved as a result of this process. We were all concerned about endangered species. You know, I often feel this whole climate change issue is a little bit unfair, because they complain about the polar bear not being able to hide on the ice because the ice is melting, so he can't hide from the seals. Nobody says, yay for the seals! Great opportunity for them. Go for it, seals. Amazing, the value system we evolve out of leaving God out of the picture. Okay, remember that statement I made? It's a statement I've gone more and more to stick with. There are many theories about space. There are many theories about life. There are many theories about politics that disagree with everything in the Bible. But the facts don't. I had one professor of physics from Manchester University come to me after a meeting very politely and said, look, it can't be as simple as you say. By the way, if you want to know what I said, I preached on all of Genesis 1. In 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth and everything that's in them. And this lady, professor of physics, said, but you know, what about the Big Bang? And I said, excuse me, madam, was that the Big Bang theory or the Big Bang fact? Because we call it the Big Bang theory, correct? No doubt about it. The Big Bang theory contradicts just about everything in Genesis chapter 1. But question, is this a fact, or is it just the latest PhD that we're all interested in because it's better than the last one? This is not a fact at all. It's a theory that depends on this assumption, that assumption, and some other assumption. The facts, well, you'll find it hard pushed to come to disagree with any facts in the world that are not matched in Genesis. While we're talking of the Big Bang, let me give you an illustration. Genesis 1:14, God made the sun and the moon and the stars for signs and times and seasons. You want to check Genesis? Go outside tonight and tell me where south is. Are there any stars up there that help you, by the way? Isn't that how Christopher Columbus not only found his way to America, he found his way back, because he lived before they had compasses. He used the stars as a sign. Signs and times. Pick up your old farmer's almanac, and they will tell you, when Scorpio gets this high, plant your wheat. They did. It always worked, for stars match the seasons. They really do. Signs and times and seasons. In fact, isn't it historically recorded in the scripture that there was a group of three astrologers who looked to the heavens for a sign about when a king would be born in Israel? That is the record the rest of the Bible gives as well in the New Testament, because that king was Jesus. Okay, one last aspect, and then we're going to have a few minutes for questions, and I'll hand back to Dave to close. Back in February 2006, Nature 16. Again, Nature, very good source, at high subscription costs, by the way. Our subscription costs for some of these magazines electronically are unbelievable. New fossil snake found at River Sleep, that's up in North Queensland, by paleontologist Dr. John Scanlon. Interesting, scary looking creature there. The fossil snake was 6 metres long and 30 centimetres wide. And that's bigger than your average green snake, even bigger than your average carpet snake around Brisbane. Now, the interesting thing is, The new fossil snake tells us, says the doctor, that enormous snakes evolved from predatory lizards like goannas, and they progressively lost their goanna features. I've got no problem with that theory except for one. If you used to have legs and you've lost them, then evolution is not the smartest word to use. If you used to have more abilities than you've got and you've lost them, then evolution is perhaps the silliest word to use. You see, he's even called this serpent an Aboriginal name, meaning the rainbow serpent. Oh, I wish he'd consulted with some of the Aborigines on this, because, you see, they don't believe in evolution at all. It's true. They all have a creationist framework. I remember one young graduate being sent by the South Australian government out to a mission station, and he was a scientific person. He was going to lift up these primitives, so he taught them the theory of evolution. And it wasn't long before the elders really complained and said, "We don't believe any of that," because their rainbow serpent is one of their creators, and away it goes. Anyway, he found this big fossil snake. He concludes that it tells us fossils, that these snakes evolved from lizards like goannas. But there's my conclusion. Change is true, but it's the opposite of evolution. And the change you'll find out there, well, distinguish the data from the story about it. When Dave asked me to do a worldview conference, a worldview is all about how you see things. And half of the problem is that Richard Dawkins has already decided there is no God. Not that he's based it on evidence, because if there is no God, there is no evidence there is no God. Huh? Because there's nothing. So therefore, he's got a view a priori before he even starts. So if you ask dear Richard, "Hey Richard, what evidence would convince you the world was created?" If he's going to be a consistent atheist, his answer is none. Otherwise, he's inconsistent. So the fact is, he's already decided. So part of the reason I've done what I've done today is to give you a way to see things and then say, well, hang on, is it the actual data that conflicts what's in the scriptures, or is it the story, Richard Attenborough, David Attenborough, the BBC, ABC, The Telegraph, or anybody else is telling me, the university lecturers here? Okay, now for some good news and for some bad news. What would you rather first? Good news? Well, I'm sorry, I'm in charge, so you're getting the bad news. Well, actually, I'm going to give you a summary of the whole talk and then launch out, really. Remember Genesis chapter 1, verse 1? In the beginning God created. Good news, you didn't have by accident. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Good news, you are not animals, you are unique. You are made in the image of God. You may be creatures, but you are not animals. Genesis 1:31. God made everything very good. Genesis chapter 3, well, the bad news is that we sin. And by the way, the bad news is so rotten because the good news was so good. And the worst thing is, remember I made that point about death being a moral penalty and not a biological necessity? And therefore, there is a way out if the penalty has been paid. And by the time you get from Genesis chapter 3 to John chapter 3, you get that famous verse that Christians love, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life." Oh, since we're on snakes this morning, I do have to remind you, verse 14 of John chapter 3 is, "Just as Moses held up the serpent in the wilderness, da-da-da-da-da, for God so loved the world." Anyone remember why Moses was holding up a snake on a pole? Answer, the people had sinned against God. God is such a righteous person, he has every right to be angry against sin, yours or the Israelites. And he had warned them, they had chosen to rebel, so he had sent serpents among them, because the wages of sin is, you don't die because you get up. They were going to die because death was a moral penalty. But the God who is a God of justice is also a God of mercy. And in condemning them, at the same time he made a way out. He said, listen, all you have to do is by faith look up at that serpent hanging up there on that tree, and if you do, I will count that as righteousness. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of academic Jews there who said, that's stupid, it can't be that simple. And here's Moses, the leader, saying, it is that simple, trust him. And if they didn't look up, guess what happened? They got bitten, they died. If they did look up, their sin was wiped away. Now, by the time you get to John chapter 3, Jesus Christ comes. Anyone remember how many times he's sinned? None. Read your Quran. Not once does it accuse Jesus of ever doing anything wrong. It's an excellent place to talk to a Muslim about who Jesus actually is. Because only God doesn't ever do anything wrong. But Jesus never did anything wrong. So when you find Jesus Christ not doing anything wrong, then you have an interesting anomaly. If you don't sin and the wages of sin is death, then if you don't sin, you shouldn't die. But if you don't sin and you do die, you can't be dying for your own sin. You must be dying for somebody else's, yours, mine. And by faith, if you accept what he did as the penalty in your place, then he will count that as righteousness which is his, and your sin is forgiven. That's simple, really. But don't be like the academic. It can't be as simple as you just said. That's why Jesus said, unless you become as a little child, you cannot even enter the kingdom of heaven. The interesting thing about your Bible is from Genesis chapter 1 to John chapter 1, it's all designed to lead you, me, the academic, the skeptic, Richard Dawkins. And he's had the gospel shared with him, right? He knows what the gospel is, that Jesus lived a sinless life, he's the creator, he died on the cross and he did it for you. And then he says, how pathetic. I hope you don't.